That sounds like an expectant hush. good afternoon to you all. My name's Jonathan Green, and we're about to have a conversation with the woman to my left, Jane Smiley. Before we begin, we're gathered on the lands of the Kaurna people. Unceded territory that was occupied by those people for some 60 millennia, the plains, the rivers, the hills of this place, a place to which the Kaurna people maintain a spiritual connection, an unbroken connection, despite the impositions of colonialism. I pay my respects to their elders and to any Indigenous people in the audience today. Jane Smiley.
Uh-oh.
This is your life. Jane is prolific. I had expected on entering the retail portion of the festival to see an entire wall taken out with your work. This is not the case, sadly.
But I am not as prolific as Mr. Keneally.
There is that. You are, however, taller. So, you know, there's...
I hope I'm as funny.
It's yin and yang. 18 works of fiction. Novels for young adults. 1,000 Acres, of course, won the Pulitzer Prize. The next novel is not out yet, so your timing at this festival is unfortunate. Lucky is coming out in April.
Yeah.
So look out for that. But the current book is a dangerous business. I think it takes you to one of your, I think, favoured sort of periods in that sort of mm-hmm. Civil War-ish time mm-hmm. in the 19th century.
My editor keeps saying you can't set everything in the 1850s.
Why not?
That's what I would say. You know, it's a very interesting period.
Well, what is it about that time?
Pardon me?
What is it about that time?
Well, it was... We know now that the Civil War was coming, but the people at the time, they just thought things were maybe going bad, but they didn't know why or what was going on. And things were different in the West than they were in the East. They were more, I don't know, cowboyish. But they weren't cowboyish completely. I mean, when I chose to set this book here in Monterey, California, because that was around the time that California was... brought into the Union, which is 1849, Monterey was the capital, and everybody thought Monterey was going to be the big town. But there were problems with Monterey. One of them was that the ships could not reliably land in the bay because of the geographical orientation of the bay. And I'm sorry, but the gold wasn't there. And so things headed north to San Francisco. And the result for those of us who live in Monterey and the Monterey area now was that it's paradise.
Where is it on the cowboy scale?
Well, actually, the village that I live in, which is Carmel Valley Village, is the cowboy village. And it contrasts very nicely with the railroad plantation in Pebble Beach, which is covered with fog. The artsy, craftsy, rich people place in Carmel by the sea, where your two-bedroom shack costs $4.5 million. And the historical things in Monterey, the beautiful sort of landscape in Salinas, the farming landscape that John Steinbeck grew up in. And it's a wonderful place to live.
Do you manage to keep horses there?
Yes, that's why I chose Carmel Valley. That's where that's where all the horses were.
We're both horsey. There was a great risk that this conversation could devolve into a thing about saddle fit and bit varieties.
Yes, but we promise it won't be about
we'll
that.
We'll keep that to ourselves. You wanted to be a jockey, of course.
I did.
What went wrong?
Can't you tell? No, I topped out at 6'2" when I was 14 years old, so I knew that jockey thing wasn't gonna work.
When did you become comfortable with yourself as that person, that 6'2"?
When I was
person?
14.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was never a problem. I've loved it every minute.
Does it make you feel sort of magisterial?
No, it gives me a good opportunity to spy on other people.
Which is a thing as a writer you do.
You betcha.
Tell us about that, because the writer's ears are always open in a particular way.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have ideas of your own, but what one of the things I like as a writer is to have a whole bunch of ideas sort of popping around in my head at the same time. And sometimes they relate to the ones you already have, and sometimes they're new, but they make you curious about something. So, for example, when I was in college, I took medieval literature, and I was mostly interested in English medieval literature, but then there was a guy in graduate school who taught Old Norse, and I thought, that sounds interesting. And so I read, I got into his classroom, and I read basically all of the sagas. And that got me interested in Greenland, so I wrote the Greenlanders.
You did a Fulbright in Reykjavik.
Yes, I did a Fulbright in Iceland, and I just couldn't stop thinking about what had happened to the Greenland population. So I wrote the Greenlanders. When I was in high school and college, we constantly read King Lear. And the thing that made me annoyed but also made me curious was why Goneril and Regan didn't get to talk and Lear never shut up. I mean, not Lear. Lear never shut up.
Can I pause? I want to go back to the sagas, but I want to pause you on that Lear point, the relationship between these three daughters with Lear, which you develop in your take on the tale.
Well, in the play, Lear clearly has a favorite, which we weren't allowed to have when I was a parent. When I was a parent of young children, and I always wondered why he preferred Cordelia, and I always wondered what was motivating Goneril and Regan, and so. I knew I wanted to rewrite it, but I had to find some kind of background material. And as always with a Shakespeare play, there is some background material. And there was some hint in one of the pieces that I read that Lear had violated at least one of the older daughters. And I said, well, that's a perfect reason why Goneril and Regan are hostile to him. But since he's the king, they have to stick with him in some way.
How does that explain Cordelia?
He didn't do it to her because she was the sweetheart. And he was just using the older ones. Which is not to say that I think that Shakespeare had the same idea. You know, maybe as a woman writer, that came into my mind as a likelihood more than it came into his mind.
The book is 1,000 Acres, and this is the Pulitzer-winning book. And that idea of you're a woman writer, that you are taking a woman's eye to these great tales, but also to the events of the history that you document. I mean, that's an important element of your work.
Well, I was lucky to grow up when I did, because publishing changed. When I was a writing student in the Iowa Writers' Workshop, my best friend was an avid writer, but she decided to become a publisher. And about the same time that she went into the publishing business, a lot of women went into the publishing business. And so the idea of which writers would get promoted shifted to more women writers. We didn't all have to be Norman Mailer or Philip Roth. We could write our own stuff. My favorite story.
I'm imagining you as Norman Mailer.
My favorite story about my writing career is that so my friend went to work for Harper and Row, and when I had finally written my first book, which would have been probably in 1979, when I was ready to be shown to her, her boss, she was an editor's assistant, and her boss was having Freudian psychological appointments 5 days a week. And so he told her, that she could buy whatever she wanted as long as she didn't spend much money. So I gave it to her, and she read it, barn blind it was, and she bought it for what I thought was plenty of money, which was $5,000. And that allowed me to kind of sneak in the doorway of being published and being an author, and to come to understand what it was like before I actually produced a book that was going to be a big deal.
How did you imagine that panning out from that beginning? I mean, this is a writing life. Was there any concept of that, or was there something?
I had
you
no
just
idea. I just wrote the books and sent them in and hoped for the best.
It's could have worked out.
Well, I prefer, I like publishing. I like having readers. I like talking, yak, 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 yak. But I like writing the best. And so one of the things I'm most grateful for in my career is that I've been allowed to keep going by my publishers.
I'm intrigued by how much of that writing work that you do in the bath.
I do the reading in the bath.
Oh, silly me.
But I wouldn't dare take my laptop into the bathtub.
It's part of your daily routine, though, isn't it, to unzip a Diet Coke, to take your we have the product placement here for those who are curious, to take your reading matter into the hot tub and settle down. It's good to have routine, don't get me wrong.
Well, I have a friend who did a... she's a neurologist, yeah. And she did study of creativity. And one of the things she discovered was that if you're making something, and it doesn't matter what it is that you're making, you have to take a break from it because your brain has to be able to kind of sift out the stuff that made you annoyed or... the confusing things that might continue if you didn't take a break. What? And so my experience is I write something, I take a break, which could be going into the hot tub, it could be going for a walk, it could be going to ride a horse, and I have an idea. The thing that confused me while I was working on it that day, suddenly I have an idea. Now, because I'm forgetful and have been my entire life, thanks to the internet, I can email myself a reminder.
Blessing.
It's been great.
What part? It's a really interesting part of the writing I find as a part of the writing process. There is great joy in reworking the thing that you just wrote.
Yeah.
In going without the pressure of making the thing appear,
yes,
to go back over that and then feed into that the ideas that occur and on you go to the next thing.
I really like rewriting. Some of them have been harder than others. Mm. And each of my books has been different from each of the others, and that's been quite interesting to me. But, for example, when I was writing The Greenlanders, because I wanted to put it in an archaic style that would be similar to something that had been translated from Old Norse, it took me a really long time to sort out the first 50 pages of the manuscript, which probably is about the first 30 pages of the book. And then I figured it, then it sort of took shape and it got into my brain, and then I would sit down and keep going with the story. And it just sort of came through me in a rush. I would sit down and think I had been writing for an hour, and I would have been writing for 5 hours. And I've only had that experience once. When I was writing Moo, so when I started out, I wanted to do the same thing as Mr. Shakespeare, whom I call Uncle Bill. I wanted to write comic novels. I wanted to write tragic. I wanted to write epic. And I wanted to write romance.
It's a good model.
And, yeah, he was a great model, I have to say. And so each one that I've written. So the comic one is Moo. The tragic one is 1,000 Acres. The epic one is The Greenlanders. And the romance one, and romance is not love, it's travel. In from medieval times. And the romance one is The All True Travels and Adventures of Liddy Newton. And then I wrote one called Horse Heaven about horse racing with a comic horse, a tragic horse, an epic horse named Epic Steam, a romance horse, a realistic horse, and a surrealistic horse.
And the Last 100 Years trilogy, is that the histories?
That could be. By that time, I just wanted to write about a long book about a family. I was curious about how families spread out, what they learned from earlier generations. So I wanted to write a book about 100 years of a family that begins on an Iowa farm.
We might come back to them because it raises really important ideas about our world as well. Mm-hmm. I want to, and I'm very keen for you to take us back to Monterey and read in a moment. But before we do that, can we just talk about the Norse sagas and this idea of old story and and how they work and what they are trying to say about the world and how that influenced you?
Well, what struck me about the sagas when I started reading them was that they were novels and that the people who were writing the sagas, even though their way of writing them was much more difficult than ours is, for example, they had very many of the same ways of going about writing the story.
For example?
I can't even remember. It's been so long since I read them. But this is what I was thinking at the time.
Yeah.
And so they had to be able to distinguish the characters. You had to be able to understand what happened. They had to make it suspenseful. They had to know exactly what sort of landscape they were writing about. And so you could tell the difference in the sagas between which ones were set slightly north of the others in Iceland, for example. And the characters were always different and intriguing. I think my favorite was probably Njal's saga.
In which?
I don't remember.
Okay.
You said, don't you realize you're interviewing an old person?
I'm so sorry.
Jeez.
Let's go to something you do remember.
I remember writing this book.
This book. And what's this to me? Phil, you had a girlhood fascination with Nancy Drew and Christie, Agatha Christie stories.
Agatha Christie, yeah.
Finally, after all these books, you write this
murderous
mystery.
My third book was a murder mystery called Duplicate Keys that was set in New York City. And its inspiration was a teacher of mine in Iowa City. And one time I stayed with her in New York, which is where she lived. And she said that she had given away so many keys to her apartment that she couldn't remember who had them or how many she had given away. And this was a woman who lived on the Upper West Side.
What can possibly go wrong?
And that's what gave me the idea. What can possibly go wrong? And nothing ever went wrong with her, but I decided to use her apartment as the site of a murder mystery. And that was the first one. But then some years ago, I thought I would do a Joyce Carol Oates sort of thing, and I would start writing a bunch of murder mysteries in under a fake name.
Nice idea.
And I would set them all in California, and they'd all be in a different county in California. And then I realized, geez, there are 58 counties in California. That's going to take a while. Will I live that long?
So then you wrote the Eleanor Ferrante books instead.
I wish.
Yes.
But anyway, since Monterey was the first capital of California, I thought I'd set it there. And Monterey is a beautiful town, and they've done a wonderful job of maintaining the old buildings. And obviously, they aren't as old there as they are in England. But
do you get the feel?
You can walk around and you get a wonderful feeling for the landscape, a wonderful feeling for what it felt must have felt like back in the 1850s to live there. So that was my inspiration.
Jane is about to read the beginning of this story. This, I must warn you, is a thinly veiled attempt to get you hooked.
Of course. Why am I here?
The book will be available for sale and signature after this event. Jane.
I will say there's another book in there that is one of my total favorites, which is Perestroika in Paris.
Yes.
And that's about a horse who's a racehorse at Auteuil, and she escapes into Paris to the west side, and she lives around the Place du Trocadéro for about 6 months. So that's one of my favorites.
It's a wonderful piece of sort of elegant absurdity.
Oops. 2 months after her husband died on November 12, 1851, Eliza Ripple stopped writing letters to her mother back in Kalamazoo. The reason was both simple and complex. Her mother had written her 3 letters, all of them lamenting and lamenting and lamenting Peter's demise. But apart from the shock, which was perfectly understandable given that he was shot in a bar fight in Monterey, Eliza was more relieved than upset. They had been married for a little over 2 years. She was 18 when her father handed her over to Peter, who was 38. Eliza had hardly known Peter at the time, as he was new to Kalamazoo, visiting a cousin he had there. He had presented himself as prosperous and well-mannered, an experienced traveler with connections and funds. Eliza had offended both of her parents by becoming fond of a boy her age from Ireland, County Cork, who worked at a lumber mill, though not the one her father owned, was tall and handsome, spoke with a lilt, hadn't a penny, and was, of all things, Catholic. All of the members of her family, staunch Covenanters, were convinced that the Irish, especially those from Cork and Dublin, were soulless sinners. Her father had pointed to a freed slave who'd run across the Ohio River to Cincinnati and then made his way north and said, "Better Josiah Grant than that bog trotter." Peter never told her parents that he was a Covenanter or even a Presbyterian, but he had the right name, Cargill, and was happy to be married in their little church in Kalamazoo. And the only thing Eliza could think of while the ceremony was taking place was the sight of Liam Callahan standing on the corner of Lovell Street and Park Street, the red autumn leaves fluttering above him, staring at their carriage as they drove to the church. Perhaps her parents assumed that Peter would settle down in Kalamazoo, buy himself a sturdy house, and produce the grandchildren her mother was ready for. But once the snow melted off in the spring, Peter was already preparing himself for California, the gold rush, his future wealth, and whatever wealth he had was all in the future. By the Christmas after they married, Eliza knew perfectly well the wealth he had wooed her parents with was a mirage. And Eliza, of course, was to come along as his servant. That was clear, too. It was not that Eliza's parents disagreed with the idea that Eliza was born to be Peter's servant, but they did not act out their beliefs. In actual fact, her father was her mother's servant and had been as long as Eliza could remember. They slept in different rooms. He was to knock if he wanted to enter, because if he came in suddenly, he would give mother a headache. He was to let her decide what was to be done with the house or the garden or the horses or Eliza. At the end of each month, when he brought home his profits from the mill, he handed them to mother, who divvied up the money to pay the bills and then sent him to the bank with what was left. Eliza was their only offspring. More evidence for Eliza once she was married that mother called the shots. These sorts of things would never happen with Peter. Part of the reason Eliza didn't mourn him, and part of the reason she was now earning her living, and a good living, in Monterey, was that he had made it clear that he intended to put it to her whether she liked it or not, once or twice, every day. And then, when she felt the quickening, he took her to a woman on South Pitcher Street in Kalamazoo who gave her some concoction and kept her overnight. She never saw the remains. After that, he regularly pulled out and also bought a few rubber things that he used. When he got her to Monterey, he found a doctor who gave her her own rubber thing, a pessary, which she was to wash and insert and take care of. If there was anything that she was thankful for to Peter Cargill, if there was anything she was thankful to Peter Cargill for, it was the knowledge that enabled her not to be impregnated again. Thank you.
There's a wonderful sense in that of whisking the reader up and placing them instantly into this complex world and giving them that sort of instant entree into a whole lot of stuff, which is obviously immediately captivating, but I imagine this is a hard thing to do, is to dispense with a lot of preliminaries and just be there.
Well, it varies from book to book, but with a murder mystery, you have to start with something dramatic. And I knew that there had to be a reason. I knew that when Eliza was in Monterey or when she got to Monterey, she had to be able to earn her living because I wanted her to be self-supporting. But there weren't many ways for a woman to earn her living in Monterey, and there were fewer women than men in Monterey at the time. So it was pretty clear in my mind that she was going to go into the sex worker business. But I decided to make the woman who runs the brothel, I decided to make her a very sensible, determined, and knowledgeable woman about that business.
Do you think that would be... I can see how that's a useful thing authorially. Do you think that would be representative, or is it not important to sort of be historically precise?
Well, you know, when I was finished writing the book, I gave it to the local historian who specialized in Monterey history. And he went through it word for word, or word by word, and he corrected some things, but he thought that the ideas of the brothel were realistic, probable. Her friend in the book, who's one of my favorite characters, works in a different brothel, but it's a brothel for women. Her name is Jean. And I said, well, what do you think about that establishment? And he said, plausible. And, you know, if you want plausible...
That's good.
...for Monterey, there's a building in Monterey that's still actually there that was brought from Australia. Every board, every nail, everything they needed to build this building was shipped to from Australia to Monterey around the same time as that.
I'm very curious about that, but I feel like it's a tangent.
When they first brought it, they made it into a hotel, and then it became a theater. And now it's just kind of sitting there while they're trying to figure out what to do with it. But if they could do that, then there could be a brothel for women.
A book of strong women, a book that centers female experience, that is also a murder mystery, but is full of sex positivity. I mean,
well, there was. Why wouldn't there be? She's the worst partner. She's already had him. And Mrs. Parks wants her girls to be safe. And so she hires someone to keep his eye on what's going on. And she gives the girls a way to alert him and kick a few out. But a lot of the guys come in, and there's one guy who's been on a ship, shipping vessel, for an enormous amount of time, like 6 months. He wants a rest. He wants some affection. And he's nice to her, and almost everybody is nice to her. And according to the Monterey historian, that was a characteristic of men in Monterey in the 1850s because there were so many fewer women.
Because we tend to imagine otherwise, I guess. We tend to imagine this is a brutish and violent time.
Not in Monterey. Maybe elsewhere, but there's the evidence is that in Monterey it was not.
I'm also wonderfully reassured of the existence of a place called Kalamazoo. This sort of says something nice about, I don't know, American culture. It's fanciful and yet serious.
Well, you know, I grew up in St. Louis, and one of the suburbs that we lived in was called Creve Coeur, which means broken heart, as you no doubt know. So if you can name a wealthy suburb broken heart, you can name it anything.
I want to go to that part of the world and the last 100 years books. Mm-hmm. This is so bold. This
Why?
Is such a grand venture. Well, to have the ambition to take that family and to take them through generations and through.
But you know,
that
when you get to when you get to a certain age, you understand that your own family has been. There have been many generations. I was raised by my grandparents. Well, because my mother had a job, my father was out of the picture. And my grandparents told so many stories about when they were young or when my mother was young. And it really got me into the mode of thinking about families, you know, the history of various families.
You wrote, it's a beautiful piece in The New Yorker about your dad and his absence in your
my
life.
My absent father, it was called, yeah.
Yeah, but you say that when you were small, there was a period in your life when your father was a fictional creation, when your father was just a manifestation of your mother's stories.
Well, my father was out of my life by the time I was a year old. And I only saw him once when I was about four. He was diagnosed at the time as having schizophrenia. Mm. And then he went into one institution and then another institution. And he and my mother split. And, you know, because I don't know why it was, but I didn't have any attachment to him. Maybe it was because I was only a year old when he was out of the
picture. Is that defensive?
No. I don't think he ever did anything bad. Mm. I think he just, one of the stories my mother told was, and he was he was 6'4", really gorgeous. And I think my mother was attracted to him because they had both been in the Second World War. And they had met there. And then they had come back, and then they got back together again. And I think he still looked great, and he was also a good prospect.
Gregory Peck, isn't that the...
Sort of.
Yeah.
He's peckish. but when my mother was pregnant with me, she was walking down the street. They were walking down the street in L.A. Where they lived, because he was looking for a job in L.A. in the airplane business. And he went into a church, and he was an atheist. So my mother couldn't figure out why he went into the church. He went into the church, he knelt down, he stood up, and he turned to her and said, "I am told you were given to me as my handmaiden." And my mother just went, uh-oh.
Chill.
Yeah, my mother was independent. She worked in a newspaper business.
She was keen to be a writer.
She wanted to be a writer. She did not expect to be anybody's handmaiden.
And despite this absence between you and your father, you once your writing life is established, you send him some books, get no response from that. But when he dies... One of your books is in his bed.
Yeah, I can't remember which one it was. He died at 66, so I don't remember which one it was. But I thought that
poignant.
Was really interesting that book was there. Maybe he was reading it. He did not believe in literature or fiction. He believed in science and math, and that's a good reason why I'm glad he wasn't in my life.
back to the century. And World War II, big in the life of your parents, and of course a peak in this century you describe. I wonder about World War II, and I wonder about how that affected the people of those generations, and it's generations each side of that event, and what the absence of that... It's almost a strength of sort of moral influence from that event had at that time and the absence of it now.
I don't know if I can answer that question because I came from... So my father and two of my uncles had been in World War II, and they all had different responses. My cousin's father was a photographer whose job was to lay in the bottom of a plane and take pictures of the damage done by various bombings. And when he was out of the war and the war was over, if he heard a loud explosion, he would hit the ground. So there was some trauma there. My other aunt's husband was also in the war, and I think that made him sort of dictatorial. But for my father, I think the war wasn't about combat. It was about trying to come up with ideas or inventions that would help the U.S., or the Allies, rather, win. And every time he tried, he failed. So he was constantly being moved. When he was at West Point, he was in the cavalry, but they got rid of the cavalry, obviously, for all sorts of reasons, for World War II, because what good was the cavalry? But they put everybody in tanks, and my father was too tall for a tank, so that was that. So he was constantly being moved around, constantly being asked to do this or that, and constantly not succeeding in what he wanted to do.
It's a turning point for the culture. I think there's... And what one of the things in the century trilogy, there's a sort of a before and after almost in that. There's mm-hmm. this little passage from Claire Langdon as an old woman,
yes,
recalling a previous time. She says, "What did I love? I think all the scents. Mama's lilac trees and the wild iris in the fields and the rain on the breeze on a hot day, apple and pear blossoms, the hay just cut, the mix of odours in the barn when the sunlight was shafting through the cracks in the boards, heating everything up." Such an evocation of a sensual lost world. I mean, it's...
One of the things about the trilogy that I wanted to explore, the Last Hundred Years trilogy, was the shift in farming away from what we would call sort of organic-like farming to chemical farming. That was something that fascinated me for as long as I lived in Iowa. And I knew when I was living in Iowa that I was being exposed to toxins, and that we all were. And I wanted to explore that. So the trilogy begins in 1920, where the family farm is not very big. And
they use draft horses.
They use draft horses, and they fertilize with natural substances. And the St. Louis-based Devil's Company, Monsanto, has not done anything yet.
They do. I mean, that's the arc of these books is from that rich horse-turned soil to this chemically constructed layer of growing medium, which is modern farming.
Yes.
Which is the tale of our times.
I don't know if it's a tale or a tragedy.
Hmm. I
know what I think. I don't know what to call it.
Well, what do you... I mean, this is the destruction of our world slowly.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And that was another thing I wanted to explore in several books, was how we have taken what was given us and messed it up just for the sake of money. Profit. And I'm not talking about you guys. I'm talking about the USA.
But it's the novelist's great gift is the old thing about writing of show, don't tell.
It's
the novelist's great gift not to just present a polemic, but to...
Yes.
create the story.
You have to give the reader the sense of how it felt, how things felt, and how they feel now. And that's what I've been trying to do all along. My natural predisposition is toward happy endings and comedy and that kind of thing. But if you live in a world where bad things are always happening, you have to include that stuff.
Well, the program note for this event says, she tells Jonathan Green why she believes novelists are always working at a time of turmoil. This is going to happen.
All times are times of turmoil.
What's the current turmoil, do you feel? What do you...
Haven't you been watching the news?
Well, I just want you to tell me. I have a sense of it.
Well, the current turmoil was spurred by Rupert Murdoch, the worst immigrant ever.
He's our fault, I'm afraid.
And he did it only for profit, and he will not suffer any of the consequences. But I also blame Ronald Reagan. You know, I think it was my first child was born in 1978, and I remember when I got up in the middle of the night because I lived in Iowa, and I was watching. I turned on the TV, and I held her in my arms, and they announced that Reagan had won the election in 1980, and I burst into tears because I knew that it was going to just shift, and it did.
Well, things aren't getting better insofar as presidents are concerned.
Did you say they are getting
I'm not.
They aren't getting better. I am a big fan of Biden. I think he's done a great job. All the statistics show that he's you know, given us prosperity, he's given us so many good things, and he can't get a positive response from a large amount of the community.
As a student of American culture, I mean, why is that, and why does the other guy attract such devoted following?
A jerk likes a jerk. I take one look at that guy and I say, how in the world can you be attracted to this guy? But I think it's because, and I think that the Democrats, I think they've made a few mistakes too, because they passed laws that were justifiable and good, but they didn't really talk the other side into them. I mean, I'm all for civil rights laws. I'm all for equality. I'm all for that kind of stuff. But then, I do think the worst thing that a certain someone whose name I never mention has done was to fix the Supreme Court so that they will do anything he wants, as is evident from today's news.
9-0 in his favor. Yeah.
And once the Supreme Court is completely screwed, then we have no hope, really. Or we don't have much hope. I would say we have some hope. But I always think if that certain someone is elected, he's going to turn on people like us or like the governor of California and say... I've also been avidly against the gun movement, but there's nothing we can do about it. Nothing we can do about it, apparently.
Your turn for questions is coming up. There's a microphone just on the right-hand aisle here, so form a little line. Make sure they're questions.
I'm going to say one last thing.
I'm going to ask you another question.
Go ahead.
We're not done yet. Make sure the questions, upward inflection at the end, please. If not a question mark, the full deal. Question mark and exclamation, the old interrobang, that's permissible, but not big statements. and keep it civil and polite. We insist on that. I wanted to ask you about the next book, but you can...
Oh, yeah, I'll tell about that. So
it's called Lucky.
Yes.
It's out in April.
It's out in April, at least in the States. I don't know about here. But when I went to my 50th high school reunion in 2017, one of my interviewers asked me if I'd ever set a book in St. Louis, where I grew up, and I thought, and I said, I haven't. What's wrong with me? And so I decided I was going to write an alternative autobiography of me if I'd been a musician rather than a writer. And I love music, and my family, we grew up singing around the piano.
What did you play?
I didn't play. I played the banjo for a while.
But in your alternative novel life?
I'm a singer who plays the guitar.
Okay.
A folk singer.
Joni Mitchell.
Sometimes, somebody like that. Mm. And her name is Jody, and she went to the same high school I did, and but she learned different things, and she never got married. And I totally enjoyed writing her music and her lyrics, and just reimagining my own life.
There's a potential spin-off project here for someone to take those songs.
Wouldn't that be nice? Volunteers accepted.
If you're listening, Taylor. How about that?
That would be lovely.
Yes, please.
Hi, thank you so much. I just wanted to ask you to talk a bit about the Jewels, your novels for young people. Mm. How did you come to do that? What's the project there? Because they're terrific.
Thank you. Well, when I grew up, I loved horse books. And I realized how much I'd learned from the horse books and that I read, I can't remember the name of them now, but because I was an only child, and I thought all the time I was growing up that I was going to find a horse in the woods who was going to be my friend. Unfortunately, it never happened, but I was allowed to take riding lessons. But when I moved to where I live now, near Monterey in California, I was introduced to the fact that some local people, two guys, two brothers, had reformed horse training, took it away from the old sort of carrot or stick method, and turned it into teaching the horse how to cooperate with, and to want to cooperate with the rider. The teachers that I took on when I first brought my horses to this place in California were exactly that kind of people. They were very observant about how the horses behaved. They acknowledged that the horses had their own opinions, and they won them over by getting them to cooperate. And I wanted to write books about that for kids who liked horse books. And so that was the inspiration. And then they were fun. So there's five books about a young woman in the 50s whose family owns a farm and the things that she learns from these instructors. And then there are three, which are actually my favorites, about one of her students who's what we would have called when I was growing up contrary. And I really enjoyed those. She's kind of a version of me. Her family can't afford a horse, but they can afford a few lessons. She wants a horse more than anything. And she meets up with a young horse that she really connects with. And those are those three, the contrary girl. So I enjoyed writing those a lot. They were fun.
I've got all these horse questions now, but it would quickly deteriorate.
Don't
as
ask
a
me how much money I lost
no,
going into the horse business.
I won't do that, sir.
Okay, Jane, thank you. Well, welcome. I mean, thank you for coming. Very inspiring. I just want to, practically, how do you go about writing a book? How long do you spend researching? How long did your first book take? How long do you take now? Do you write by paper onto a computer? Just some of the technical practices.
I write on the computer. I write on my Apple laptop, and I call myself très prussienne because I write in bed. But when I started out, I wrote on a typewriter. And then when I was writing when I was about to start writing The Greenlanders, I bought one of the original quote-unquote portable computers, which was as heavy as a sewing machine. But one of the things that happened was that since I was not writing on a typewriter, I never took the piece of paper out and put another piece of paper in, so I never paused. And that's one of the reasons that The Greenlanders has no chapters. And it's also one of the reasons that it just came right through me. Because there was nothing that reminded me that I needed to pause. I did write about the various difficulties I had with different books in my book 13 Ways of Looking at the Novel, which I read about 130 books, starting with The Tale of Genji, and 130 novels, excuse me, starting with The Tale of Genji, and moving forward to about, I guess it was 2005, I guess. And I was curious about the nature of the novel. And then, so there's a whole section about the various novels that I read. And then there's chapters about what I learned from reading them. And included in that are some things that I discovered. Two of the chapters are A Novel of Your Own, Part One. And the thing I learned about that was, for the first draft, just keep going. A Novel of Your Own, Part Two, and then the thing I learned about that was try this, try that, try this, but also keep going. Yeah, but I think the best chapter for me in it are the two chapters about the structure of the novel. And one of them has this novel clock where I talk about the various parts of a novel and which ones the various novels that I read contained. And almost all of them, if not all of them, contained gossip. And I said, yes. So gossip is really important. Because the characters have to talk to one another. They have to learn things about one another. And then I also put in a bit about the pyramid of the novel. So the pyramid of the novel is this triangular thing that has four layers. The bottom layer is language, and that's the door. The next layer is plot and character, and that's what murder mysteries have or focus on. The layer above that is setting and theme, and that's what gives the author a kind of meaning. Most literary novels are really about setting and theme with some characters and plot. Most murder mysteries are about plot and character with some setting and theme. And then there's the tip, which is complexity. And the thing I learned about complexity was that not everything can be complex. You have to pick what's going to be complex. And if you pick the language, then critics are going to love you the way they loved James Joyce, and readers are going to say, I didn't understand a word.
That's what you want.
That's apparently what you want.
I'm a big fan of old manuscripts when people used to write by hand and then correct by hand, and you these images of these incredibly messy things which slowly take shape. And as someone like you who grew up using a typewriter, then moved to a computer, this age of sort of liquid correction of a much more sort of organic process of forming words. I wonder how it's changed forming of words.
When I was in Paris, if you're going to write a book about Paris, you have to go there over and over and do a lot of research, especially in restaurants.
Just keep telling your publisher that.
But one of the things I did in Paris was to go to the Balzac Museum. And it's got lots of displays of pages that Honoré Balzac wrote. And I could not have been more grateful to be me rather than him, at how he had to write it and what he had to put up with in order to produce all of those books. And the other thing is that when I first started out, the research, you had to go find the encyclopedias, you know, the World Book or whatever it was. And you had to call people, and you do, now the research is on the web.
Well, and the stuff that's fabulous. you can research in process of, oh, that sentence, I need to know this. I can quickly find that out.
Yeah, and you can take, you can go to a neighborhood, and you can have the Google boy walk around the neighborhood, and you say, oh, I'm going to set it there.
Thank you very much for coming and your lovely talk. I also have a question a bit about the Greenlanders. I'm interested in what you just said about your sense of flow because of using this new medium. Did you gradually sort of change your style after that? And also I wanted to ask, how was the Greenlanders received in Greenland and Denmark?
I have no idea about the last part. In my experience, you guys can tell me, but there's always somebody in the audience who's read the Greenlanders more than once.
Should we test that?
No, you can if you want.
Okay, who's read the Greenlanders more than once?
We're too far south for that, I guess. but, you know, if I wanted to write the Greenlanders now, I could send the Google boy to Greenland, and the Google boy would look around, and I would see it on my computer. When I was writing it in 80, when I was researching it in 84, I went to Greenland myself and looked around. So I still prefer looking around on my own and seeing what it would feel like to be somewhere. Mm. I still prefer reading a lot of books in the style that were written in the time that the book is set. So, because I like the prose to be similar to what the characters would have been talking about in those days. I love doing research. I'm glad it's easier on the computer, but I'm happy to go to libraries. I'm happy to talk to people. I'm happy to go for visits. You know, I'm happy to do whatever I have to do.
I asked you before about, with that first book published, the prospect of that writing life. I'm wondering, and you said, well, I don't know, I just wrote the book. In reflection, that journey through all these books, what's your sense of that
achievement? I enjoyed them. The only one I had trouble with was Private Life, and it was because there's a crackpot in Private Life. And he was a true crackpot who actually lived. And I really had never met a crackpot. So it took me a really, really long time. And I went back and forth and back and forth with my editor about why my portrayal of this guy wasn't working. And finally, I got some kind of insight into... I didn't want to diagnose him. He wasn't living in our time. I didn't want to diagnose him with a particular mental illness because I didn't want to think of him in modern ideas. But I finally managed to think of him. And he continued to be a crackpot. He was based on a... This is the last thing I'll say, but in the book, he's called... God, I can't remember. But he was based on a relative. My grandfather was one of 10, and one of his older sisters married a local guy who was a physicist from central Missouri who ended up in Northern California, whose only job, because he was a crackpot, was to observe what time of day they dropped the ball to show that it was midnight. And then he reported that to the local shippers, and then they knew what time it was. That was his only job. But he had all these theories, and one of his theories was that Einstein was an idiot because he believed in the theory of ether. He believed in all that early stuff. Anyway, when my great aunt died in the early 50s, a couple years after that, he had plenty of money. A couple years after that, he took the ship to, or a plane or something, to Stockholm and offered to give a speech to the people at the Nobel Institute.
Splendid crack pottery.
And they all agreed, and they all got dressed up, and they sat in the audience, and he gave this speech about how Einstein was an idiot. And then, goodness me, they didn't give him the Nobel Prize. So 2 years later, he went back. And of course, they were very kind and generous, and they let him in. But the only people in the audience who were also dressed up were the grounds crew. So he never got the Nobel Prize.
It's a very sweet tale. crackpots are welcome at the signing desk shortly, where Jane will be.
But I'm glad that nobody answered. The worst question I ever got was, are you ashamed of telling lies for a living?
Oh, harsh. That person need not attend at the
signing desk. Well, I explained to him what willing suspension of disbelief
yes,
was.
Yes, it's not a fine line at all. A Dangerous Business is available in the retail outlet. Jane will be happy to sign your copies. And if you could please thank Jane Smiley.
Thank you for coming. It's been great to have a chat with
this guy.